Mr. Shaw, Reel 12. We were talking about your time on HMS Milne and your role as Chief ERA, Boilermakers, and you were talking about the water test and what would happen if there's too much salt in.
Well, the boilers would tend to prime, which means that you'd carry water, modules of water over with the steam, and that could damage the turbine blades eventually, you see. So it was always something to watch out for. So you had to keep the density of the water. You had to check the water regularly to make sure that everything was all right.
Anything else you were doing on the mill?
Well,
would you take a normal watchkeeping turn?
No, but you could volunteer. You wouldn't have to, but you could volunteer to give one of the others a bit of a break, go down for a couple of hours down the engine room, and that was it. But that was voluntary. You didn't have to do it.
And you did it?
Yeah, occasionally, yeah. But you had to. And that was about it, really.
Now, anything particular happened? How long did you stay in the Mediterranean on this?
We're in December 44, January 45, and the war finished. Right, now, so, as luck would have it, we were actually in Malta on VE Day.
So nothing in particular happened. It was routine again for you.
That's right. Yeah, we didn't get involved in anything special. No terrific excitement. And
so, what do you remember of VE Day then?
We were in Sliema Harbour in Malta.
Which harbour?
Sliema Harbour in Malta, and it was quite warm. What was it, May? It was May, and it was quite warm, and some of us were sleeping on the upper deck instead of on camp beds on the upper deck. And then I think it must have been about 5 o'clock in the morning, everybody was awakened by terrific dins of sirens going all over the show and whatnot. The war in Europe was finished. Everybody was up cheering like mad, you see. And now, let me see, that was May, that's right. Then we wondered then, of course, what was going to happen. None of us were too keen to go out to Japan. But we didn't quite know what was going to happen. And as it happened, we weren't involved in the Japanese war. We were sent to the Eastern Mediterranean. And it was at the time when we were trying to prevent Jews illegally entering Palestine, and that was part of our job, to stop some of these ships going in and out. And we were based mainly in Haifa. We go up to Tel Aviv occasionally, and we went to Beirut on one occasion, and we used to call it the Palestine Jewish Patrol, you see. And we managed to organise quite a few games of football while we were there.
Do you remember, before we go to that, do you remember much about the actual role, you know?
Well, we would be at sea searching for boats, any of boats that we suspected might be bringing illegal Jewish immigrants into Palestine, you see. And if we spotted one, and they had a special crew, and they would go on, they would sort of stop. We'd stop the vessel, warn them, and then this crew would go on board to investigate, you see. And there was always an ERA, there was always one ERA chosen to go because of the engine, the motor, the boat engine, you see. I don't know who it was, to be quite honest, from the film. It wasn't me, anyway. And that was it, sort of. But we didn't really. If I remember rightly, I think it was only on one occasion that we suspected that this particular boat was carrying Jewish immigrants. So as far as we were concerned, nothing really happened. And then eventually...
Now what about the football?
Yeah, well, we used to play football, and we played the... We played football in Beirut, but mainly we played in Haifa, and we could... I used to organise a lot of football fixtures amongst the ships, the different parts of the ship, you know, the seamen and the stokers, etc., etc., so they all had a team, and I used to organise that sort of thing. I would get in touch with the authorities ashore and see whether there was a pitch available, etc., and what time, and so forth and so on. And we used to have quite a few games.
And you were still playing, of course.
Well, I was still playing then, yeah. Did you see that?
An injury to your finger?
Yeah, I did that in Beirut.
How?
In 1945, yeah, it was 45, it could have been the beginning of 40, anyway, 45. Well, we were playing the Chiefs and POs team, I think we're playing another part of the ship, and the ground was, you can imagine the ground's baked very hard, and on this particular occasion, one of my own team, I went to flick the ball over like that, and he went to kick it, and his leg caught underneath mine, and I went up in the air, and as I landed down on the pitch, this finger took the, and I still can't bend it right, but for years, I couldn't bend it more than that, and gradually got it, and that's the result of it, Beirut. Anyway, you could have heard the language when I called this chap. He was twice as big as me, but so I did that in Beirut. And we did this for a while. And
were you aware of the Jewish-Arab thing and how serious it all was at the time? Or did you have any opinions? Were you on one side or the other?
Well, we didn't know a lot about it. We knew that we were supposed to stop them trying to get in. Do you want my personal opinion?
Just as it was then, yes.
Yeah, as it was then and it still is. I think it shouldn't. I don't think the Jews should ever have been allowed into Palestine. That's just my personal opinion. But that's not necessarily. That probably isn't the opinion of lots of people. But that's mine anyway.
So you favoured the Arab view, the Arab side?
Well, the way I saw it was that if it was anyone's country, it was there. So I at the back of my mind, I was thinking to myself, well, let's suppose in the Roman Catholics decided they wanted a country of their own. What do we do? Let them have a half of Europe or something? Or, you know, it didn't make sense to me that the Jews are religious. It just didn't make sense to me. I mean, I don't know, I might be wrong here, but I think that the Palestine belongs to the Arabs. And I've always thought that. But I say, I'm prepared to be told differently, but no one's ever been able to prove that otherwise to me. But that was just my personal opinion.
You stayed doing that job into 46.
That's right. And then we came back to Malta, I think in February 46, and quite a lot of us left the ship, and I was one of them. They kept a few on board to take it back to UK, and that was usually the people who were hostilities only who were due to go out anyway. Although the chief ERA of the ship, he went back with it. But most of us came off, and then I was allocated a job on the staff of the engineer officer of Malta, who was a captain. Well, we didn't see much of him anyway, but it was on his staff. And
that's a base posting.
Yeah, that's right. And my job there was just to examine the boilers of lots of the smaller ships to see whether they needed treatment or not. And it was while I was on one of these ships...
Just the small ones?
Yes, right, just the small ones. And it was while I was going on one of these ships that this particular chief stoker at the time asked me if I recognised him. And I said, well, no, why should I? He said, yeah, he said, because I pulled you off the Carly float in the North Atlantic. And I said, well, I'm blowed. And that was then I asked him for further details. And that's, and he told me, he said, well, he said, you were the last, I think I've told you this before. And that was it, you see. But that was peculiar, wasn't it, seeing that chap? And then I got my wife out there. She came out. And
where were you living?
Sleema. We had a sort of flat in Sleema. And the officers of the were in Valletta, so I used to go around to Valletta usually by bus. And December.
So you're out there. That's 10 months you were doing that.
Yeah, from February. That's it to December, and then I came home. The came home on a ship, you know, one of the big, I can't think of the name of it now, big, fairly fair size, one of the old liners. And I can always remember we came into Liverpool, although December in Malta, and it was still quite mild, warm. When we got into Liverpool, it was one of the worst winters they've had in this country for years. There was snow everywhere and all over the show, etc., etc., etc. And I stayed with a friend of my wife's. She lived in Whitburn, you know, Whitburn on the on that coast. And then we came down to... I must have gone into barracks first, surely. I was entitled to quite a bit of leave anyway, foreign service leave, you see. And after we'd finished all that, etc., 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 and I went into barracks, and that's when I then in March joined the Anson, March 1947.
Now, what were you just chief ERA
on the Anson? But on the Anson, they had. It was in reserve, so they only had a half complement, and they didn't put to sea too often, so they only had enough for two watches. But when I joined the Anson, there were about eight chief ERAs on there, and I think they were, all of them bar one were senior to me anyway, but that didn't worry me. But we were at Portland all the time, except that 1947, I think it was, and it was somebody's coronation, I don't know, or 25th or something or other. And we went up to the Clyde, and we called in at Douglas on the Isle of Man on the way. And when we were at Douglas, Leslie Hutchison, have you heard of him? The black pianist? Well known, he was black as the hobs of hell, he was. He was invited on board, and someone I'd always wanted to see. And he was playing the piano, and somebody came rushing along to tell me, to inform me that they knew that I was interested in this chap Hutch, because I'd always been talking about it. He's playing on board the piano, and he's playing the piano and so and so position on board the ship. So I rushed up. I thought, well, I've got to see him. And when I got up on deck, there was a great big crowd there, as you can imagine, nearly all sailors. And he'd just finished one round, and everybody's shouting and clapping and applauding. And they're all shouting out, encore, encore. And just as I got, and this is true, this is not a joke, as I got up there, this elderly sailor with three badges, you know, shouted out, he said, "We don't want any bloody encores." He said, "Let's have the same one again," and he used a few expletives in front. And I can always remember that to this day. And so every time I hear somebody say encore, I always think of that chap. And there you are. So, and he carried on playing for a while. Leslie Hutchison, yeah, he's before your time, anyway.
Did you have much to do on board the Anson? You know, I mean, you were the junior of the era.
Yeah, but nevertheless, I was in charge of the boiler rooms. That my job was down in the boiler rooms. And what happened there mainly was that there'd be jobs to be done, obviously, and the jobs would be allocated to, say, one of the younger ERAs, and then my job would be to make sure that they did the job correctly, and that was it.
So not much work, really?
Not a lot, not really, just jogging.
The ship wasn't going anywhere either, was it?
No, apart from this particular trip, and it stayed in Portland most of the time, and that was it. And
what did you think of the Anson?
Well, I didn't really have a lot to... Being in the state it was in, you didn't really get the real... You didn't get a real impression.
There weren't many... What about normal crew? Were there many of them aboard?
No, it was... Probably about half the normal... We played quite a few games of cricket. I didn't play so much football then, I don't know why. Wasn't good enough. Played quite a few games of cricket.
Who would you play against?
Well, other ships. There was the King George V was in at the time, you know, another one of the big battleships we played there. We had a competition with the big ships, and we got into the final playing the King George V at Portland. But most of the time it was routine. You get a weekend every so often, about once a month or something, and you go home for the weekend, and then, of course, the leave period would crop up. Easter leave, summer leave, and that's about it.
Sounds a very... Was it dull?
Pardon?
Was it dull?
I suppose, in a way, it was, after all. But, nevertheless... You're only too thankful, you know, after the war had finished, really, to, have something like that for a change.
Now, how long were you aboard? You joined a...
March 1947 and left in September 48.
So, over a year?
Oh, yeah, over a year, yeah.
And how did you come to leave, or was it just a natural posting?
My time was up, 48, finished.
So you demobilised?
Went back to barracks, that was it, yeah.
What do you remember of your demobilisation?
Nothing, really. My birthday was the 24th of September, and usually I was under the impression that they would have you up there about a week before, but in my case I was 1 day, the day before, that was it, and I was in just going through all the routines, handing everything back that you're supposed to hand back, and that was it.
And then what?
I mean,
you've been in the Navy for a long time, you know. What did you have any idea what you were going to do?
Well, I initially wanted to join the civil service, you see. And I'd sat the examination for one of the civil service examinations, but while I was... Oh, no, I had quite a bit of leave to come as well. And while I was waiting for the result to come through, I was living in Gosport. I was living here at the time, by the way, Peel Road in Gosport. While I was waiting for the results to come through, I saw this advertisement in the local paper, Clean Easy Brush Company, representative required, no experience required, you see. So I said to my wife, well, I was sort of hanging around doing nothing for 2 or 3 months. I said, I'll have a go at that for what, you know, just to get some more money and see what it's like. So I did. But I stayed on it for 3 years. See, an Easy Bus Company. And I was the leading salesman in the Portsmouth area.
And what sort of brushes? Just household brushes?
Oh, yeah, and it was a great big... Nowadays, they just stick a folder through and walk. I was carrying a great big case, big as me, around, full of brushes and all sorts of other odds and ends, etc., etc. And I always put my success, if that's what you can call it. You only got paid on commission only, by the way. No wages, no flat wage. Down to the fact that I did the opposite to what you see in these cartoons. I didn't stick my foot in the door, and I didn't tell them that our stuff was wonderful. In fact, far from it. And I used to explain, perhaps, to a housewife, one of the main things that we used to sell was a broom, which was had a you could turn it around four different ways, sweeping broom, made of pure hair, you see. And at the time, I think it cost over £1, which was a lot of money in those days, you see. And I used to spout out about how wonderful this was, and I'd finish up by saying, and if you believe that, you believe anything, which was the complete opposite to the usual. And I got more orders than anybody else, so there must be a moral in that somewhere. Anyway, I was on that for...
You're getting good money then from the commission.
Yeah, I was at the time. Now we're talking there about 1948, 49, 50. My average was about £13 a week, and the average manual wage at that period was around about £7 or £8.
It's almost double.
So I was doing all right, but.
Did you pass? Had you passed your civil service exam?
Yeah, well, what happened was, the reason I carried on was they offered me a job in the Isle of Wight. Well, I'd only just bought this house. I'd moved over to Portsmouth then. So I thought, well, I'm not moving over to the Isle of Wight on a civil service job where the pay was about £6 a week, you see. So I thought, I'll stay in this job and see what transpires. But eventually got to the point where I couldn't see myself continually going around with this great big, and when I told the manager that I was thinking of packing up and rejoining the Navy, you could rejoin the Navy providing you hadn't been out more than 5 years. And you could go back, eventually get back to your original rank, but you had to wait. You wouldn't go in straight away. And when I told him that I was considering going back in the Navy, because he didn't want me to leave, naturally, and then eventually turned up with, we can get you a job as a branch manager in the Isle of Wight. Branch manager. Well, it still meant that I would probably have to move over there, you see. So in the end, what with one thing and another, I decided that I would rejoin, and that's the main reason I rejoined. If I could have seen myself getting somewhere on this clean, easy business, I might have stayed, but I just couldn't.
So when did you rejoin the Navy?
I think it was August, July or August 1951. And what happens is that you, to make it all legal from the naval's point of view, you've got to start off at rock bottom. So the first day, I think I was a fourth class ERA, and the second day I'm a third class, and the next day a second class, which is what I would have been had I not passed for a chief, are you with me, when I came out. So that was that. So I stayed it like that for a while, and then I think it was in the March the following year when I was confirmed again as a chief ERA. So I didn't have to wait all that long. 6 months.
What was your first posting?
To HMS Newcastle, down at Devonport. The cruiser, it was a cruiser. And it was doing a big refit at the time. I went down there in January, the end of January, 50, where we got to now, that's it, 52, yeah. And then we were there when the King George VI died, didn't he, February, that's right. And we all had to line up on the jetty there. It was raining, freezing cold, to attend his funeral service, you see. And then when the refit finished, it must have been about sometime in May, and we did trials, and then we came round to Portsmouth, and we didn't know where we were going, actually, at the time. We originally thought we were going to the Mediterranean, and we left Portsmouth in June, I can't remember the exact date in June, and the marine band was playing "I'd Like to Get You on a Slow Boat to China," by which time we knew we were going out in the Korean War. So I thought to myself, I can't win here, can I? I don't want to fight anybody, and there we are, just finished one war, and then I'm going out in the Korean War. Anyway, away we went. We called in at Malta on the way, and we got out there eventually, and as luck would have it, the Korean War finished in 53, so we didn't have a lot of it. We just had them.
Well, did you see any action?
Oh, yes, yeah, we patrolled on the western side. The Americans did the other side, the eastern side. We patrolled the western side. And part of our job was to bombard some of the enemy positions. That was the main thing. And the first patrol we did, we were at sea for 4 weeks. 4 weeks. And then we went back into Sasebo, was the base in Japan. S-A-S-E-B-O, Sasebo. And I think it was June or July the following year when they had the armistice, if I remember right. And Syngman Rhee came on board. He's only a little chap. But one of the funniest things was that when we relieved the Belfast. I think the Belfast was out there, and we relieved. And of course, you have lots of the officers go backwards and forwards to find out exactly what the duties were and all the rest of it. And one of the engineer officers was involved in this, and when he came back on board, he and several others were killing themselves laughing, you see. So I said, what's funny, what's the big joke? So one of them said, well, the Chinese are not supposed to have much sense of humour, you see. Now, the Belfast had its paying off pennant up and all the rest of it in full view of, everybody, all ready to go home. And they got a signal from the local Chinese commander who they'd been bombarding. I can't think of his name now. And I can't think of the exact wording of the signal, but it was words to this effect. Bon voyage. We will miss you as much as you have missed us in the past. Signed, Major General China. And I thought, well, there you are. So that was it.